First, everyone wants to be believed. It doesn't matter what the belief is. The experience of being believed feels good. I think these positive feelings are universal, meaning that they apply to everyone. Conversely, no one likes to be disbelieved. It doesn't feel good. If I said, "I don't believe you," the negative feeling that would resonate throughout your body and mind is also universal. By the same token, none of us likes to have our beliefs challenged. The challenge feels like an attack. Everyone, regardless of the belief, seems to respond in the same way. The typical response is to argue, defend ourselves, our beliefs, and, depending on the situation, attack back. When expressing ourselves, we seem to like being listened to. If we sense our audience isn't paying attention, how does it feel? Not good. Again, I think this response is universal. Conversely, why is it so difficult to be a good listener? Because to be a good listener, we actually have to listen without thinking about how we are going to express ourselves the moment we can, either politely or rudely interrupt the person who's speaking. What's the compelling force behind our inability to listen without waiting to interrupt? Don't we like being with people with similar beliefs because it feels comfortable and secure? Don't we avoid people with dissimilar or conflicting beliefs because it feels uncomfortable or even threatening? The bottom line implication is, the moment we acquire a belief, it seems to take on a life of its own, causing us to recognize and be attracted to its likeness and repelled by anything that is opposite or contradictory. Considering the vast number of divergent beliefs that exist, if these feelings of attraction or comfort and being repelled or threatened are universal, then each belief must somehow be conscious of its existence. And this conscious, structured energy must behave in characteristic ways that are common to all of us. The primary characteristics of a belief. There are three basic characteristics you need to understand in order to effectively install the five fundamental truths about trading at a functional level in your mental environment. 1. Beliefs seem to take on a life of their own and therefore resist any force that would alter their present form. 2. All active beliefs demand expression. 3. Beliefs keep on working, regardless of whether or not we are consciously aware of their existence in our mental environment. 1. Beliefs resist any force that would alter their present form. We may not understand the underlying dynamics of how beliefs maintain their structural integrity, but we can observe that they do so even in the face of extreme pressure or force. Throughout human history, there are many examples of people whose belief in some issue or cause was so powerful that they chose to endure indignities, torture, and death rather than express themselves in a way that violated their beliefs. This is certainly a demonstration of just how powerful beliefs can be and the degree to which they can resist any attempt to be altered or violated in the slightest way. Beliefs seem to be composed of a type of energy or force that naturally resists any other force that would cause them to exist in any form other than their present form. Does this mean that they can't be altered? Absolutely not. It just means that we have to understand how to work with them. Beliefs can be altered, but not in the way that most people may think. I believe that once a belief has been formed, it cannot be destroyed. In other words, there is nothing we can do that would cause one or more of our beliefs to cease to exist or to evaporate as if they never existed at all. This assertion is founded in a basic law of physics. According to Albert Einstein and others in the scientific community, energy can neither be created nor destroyed. It can only be transformed. If beliefs are energy, structured conscious energy that is aware of its existence, then this same principle of physics can be applied to beliefs, meaning, if we try to eradicate them, it's not going to work. If you knew someone or something was trying to destroy you, how would you respond? You would defend yourself, fight back, and possibly become even stronger than you were before you knew of the threat. Each individual belief is a component of what we consider to be our identity. Isn't it reasonable to expect that, if threatened, each individual belief would respond in a way that was consistent with how all the parts respond collectively? The same principle holds true if we try to act as if a particularly troublesome belief doesn't exist. If you woke up one morning and everyone you knew ignored you and acted as if you didn't exist, how would you respond? It probably wouldn't be long before you grabbed someone and got right in their face to try to force them to acknowledge you. Again, if purposely ignored, each individual belief will act in the very same way. It will find a way to force its presence into our conscious thought process or behavior. The easiest and most effective way to work with our beliefs is to gently render them inactive or non-functional by drawing the energy out of them. I call this process deactivation. After deactivation, the original structure of the belief remains intact, so technically, it hasn't changed. The difference is that the belief no longer has any energy. Without energy, it doesn't have the potential to act as a force on our perception of information or on our behavior. Here is a personal illustration. As a young child, I was taught to believe in both Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy. In my mental system, both of these are perfect examples of what are now inactive, non-functional beliefs. However, even though they are inactive, they still exist inside my mental system. Only now they exist as concepts with no energy. If you recall from the last chapter, I defined beliefs as a combination of sensory experience and words that form an energized concept. The energy can be drawn out of the concept, but the concept itself remains intact in its original form. However, without energy, it no longer has the potential to act on my perception of information or on my behavior. So, as I'm sitting here typing into my computer, if someone came up to me and said that Santa Claus was at the door, how do you think I would define and interpret this information? I would treat it as being irrelevant or a joke, of course. However, if I were 5 years old and my mother told me that Santa Claus was at the front door, her words would have instantly tapped me into a huge reservoir of positively charged energy that would have compelled me to jump up and run to the front door as fast as I could. Nothing would have been able to stop me. I would have overcome any obstacle in my path. At some point, my parents told me Santa Claus didn't exist. Of course, my first reaction was disbelief. I didn't believe them, nor did I want to believe them. Eventually, they convinced me. However, the process of convincing me did not destroy my belief in Santa Claus or cause it not to exist any longer. It just took all the energy out of the belief. The belief was transformed into a non-functional, inactive concept about how the world works. I'm not sure where all that energy went, but I know that some of it was transferred to a belief that Santa Claus doesn't exist. Now I have two contradictory distinctions about the nature of the world that exist in my mental system. One, Santa exists. Two, Santa doesn't exist. The difference between them is in the amount of energy they contain. The first has virtually no energy. The second has energy. So from a functional perspective, there is no contradiction or conflict. I propose that if it's possible to render one belief inactive, then it's possible to deactivate any belief, despite the fact that all beliefs seem to resist any force that would alter their present form. The secret to effectively changing our beliefs is an understanding, and consequently, believing that we really aren't changing our beliefs. We are simply transferring energy from one concept to another concept, one that we find more useful in helping us to fulfill our desires or achieve our goals. 2. All active beliefs demand expression. Beliefs fall into two basic categories, active and inactive. The distinction between the two is simple. Active beliefs are energized. They have enough energy to act as a force on our perception of information and on our behavior. An inactive belief is just the opposite. It is a belief that, for any number of reasons, no longer has energy, or has so little energy that it's no longer able to act as a force on how we perceive information or how we express ourselves. When I say that all active beliefs demand expression, I don't mean to imply that every belief in our mental environment is demanding to express itself simultaneously. For example, if I ask you to think about what's wrong with the world today, the word wrong would bring to your mind ideas about the nature of the world that reflect what you believe to be troubling or disturbing. Unless, of course, there is nothing about the state of the world you find troubling. The point is, if there is something you do believe is wrong, you weren't necessarily thinking about those ideas before I asked the question. But the moment I did, your beliefs about these issues instantly moved to the forefront of your conscious thinking process. In effect, they demanded to be heard. I say that beliefs demand to be expressed, because once something causes us to tap into our beliefs, it seems as if we can't stop the flood of energy that's released. This is especially true of emotionally sensitive issues, or beliefs we feel particularly passionate about. You might ask, why would I want to hold back expressing my beliefs? There could be several reasons. Consider a scenario in which you're interacting with someone in a superior position to you at work, and this person is saying something that you completely disagree with, or even find utterly absurd. Will you express your truth, or hold back? That will depend on the beliefs you have about what is proper in such a situation. If your beliefs dictate that speaking up would be inappropriate, and those beliefs have more energy than the ones that are being contradicted, then you'll probably hold back and not argue openly. You might be looking at this person, the boss, and nodding your head in agreement. But is your mind in agreement? More to the point, is your mind silent? Absolutely not. Your position on the issues being presented are effectively countering each point the boss is making. In other words, your beliefs are still demanding expression, but they aren't being expressed externally, in the environment, because other beliefs are acting as a counteracting force. However, they will soon find a way to get out, won't they? As soon as you are out of the situation, you will probably find a way to unload, or even spew out your side of the argument. You will probably describe what you had to endure to anyone you think will lend a sympathetic ear. This is an example of how our beliefs demand to be expressed when they are in conflict with the external environment. But what happens when one or more of our beliefs are in conflict with our intents, goals, dreams, wants, or desires? The implications of such a conflict can have a profound effect on our trading. As we have already learned, beliefs create distinctions in how the external environment can express itself. Distinctions, by definition, are boundaries. Human consciousness, on the other hand, seems to be larger than the sum total of everything we have learned to believe. This larger-than quality of human consciousness gives us the ability to think in any direction we choose, either inside or outside of the boundaries imposed by our beliefs. Thinking outside of the boundaries of our beliefs is commonly referred to as creative thinking. When we purposely choose to question a belief, question what we know, and sincerely desire an answer, we make our minds available to receive a brilliant idea, inspiration, or solution to the issue at hand. Creativity, by definition, brings forth something that didn't previously exist. When we put our minds into a creative thinking mode, we will, by definition, automatically receive ideas or thoughts that are outside of anything that already exists in our rational mind as a belief or memory. As far as I know, there is no consensus among artists, inventors, or the religious or scientific communities as to exactly where creatively generated information comes from. However, what I do know is that creativity seems to be limitless and without boundaries. If there are any limits on the ways we can think, we certainly haven't found them yet. Consider the staggering pace at which technology has developed in the last 50 years alone. Every invention or development in the evolution of humanity was born in the minds of people who were willing to think outside the boundaries dictated by what they had learned to believe. If all of us have the inherent ability to think creatively, and I believe that we do, then we also have the potential to encounter what I call a creative experience. I define a creative experience as the experience of anything new or outside the boundaries imposed by our beliefs. It could be a new sight, something we've never seen before, but from the environment's perspective, was always there. Or we could experience a new sound, smell, taste, or touch. Creative experiences like creative thoughts, inspirations, hunches, and brilliant ideas can occur as a surprise, or can be the result of our conscious direction. In either case, when we experience them, we can be confronted with a major psychological dilemma. A creative occurrence, whether in the form of a thought or an experience, can cause us to be attracted to or desire something that is in direct conflict with one or more of our beliefs. To illustrate the point, let's return to the example of the boy and dog. Recall that the boy has had several painful experiences with dogs. The first experience was real from the environment's perspective. The others, however, were the result of how his mind processed information, based on the operation of the association and pain avoidance mechanisms. The end result is that he experiences fear every time he encounters a dog. Let's suppose that the boy was a toddler when he had his first negatively charged experience. As he grows up and begins associating specific words and concepts with his memories, he will form a belief about the nature of dogs. It would be reasonable to assume that he adopted a belief something like, "All dogs are dangerous." With the use of the word "all," the boy's belief is structured in a way that assures that he will avoid all dogs. He has no reason to question this belief, because every experience has confirmed and reinforced its validity. However, he, and everyone else on the planet, is susceptible to a creative experience. Under normal circumstances, the boy will do everything possible to make sure he does not encounter a dog. But what if something unexpected and unintended occurs? Suppose the boy is walking with his parents, and as a result, feels safe and protected. Now, suppose he and his parents come to a blind corner and cannot see what is on the other side. They encounter a scene in which several children of about the same age as the boy are playing with some dogs, and furthermore, they are obviously having a great deal of fun. This is a creative experience. The boy is confronted with indisputable information that what he believes about the nature of dogs isn't true. What happens now? First, the experience was not at the boy's conscious direction. He didn't make a decision to willingly expose himself to information that contradicted what he believed to be true. We might call this an inadvertent creative experience, because the external environment forced him to confront other possibilities that he didn't believe existed. Second, the experience of seeing other children playing with dogs and not getting hurt will throw his mind into a state of confusion. After the confusion wears off, meaning as he begins to accept the possibility that not all dogs are dangerous, several scenarios are possible. Seeing other children his own age, with whom he could strongly identify, having such a great time playing with dogs, could cause the boy to decide that he wants to be like the other children and have fun with dogs too. If that's the case, this inadvertent creative encounter has caused him to become attracted to express himself in a way that he formerly didn't believe was possible, interacting with dogs. In fact, the notion was so impossible that it wouldn't have even occurred to him to consider it. Now he not only considers it, he desires it. Will he be able to express himself in a way that is consistent with his desire? The answer to this question is a matter of energy dynamics. There are two forces within the boy that are in direct conflict with each other, competing for expression. His belief that all dogs are dangerous and his desire to have fun and be like the other children. What he will do the next time he encounters a dog will be determined by which has more energy, his belief or his desire. Given the intensity of the energy in his belief that all dogs are dangerous, we can reasonably assume that his belief will have far more energy than his desire. If that's the case, then he will find his next encounter with a dog very frustrating. Even though he may want to touch or pet the dog, he'll find that he can't interact with it in any way. The word all in his belief will act as a paralyzing force, preventing him from fulfilling his desire. He might be well aware of the fact that the dog he wants to pet is not dangerous and won't hurt him, but he won't be able to pet it until the balance of energy tips in favor of his desire. If the boy genuinely wants to interact with dogs, he will have to overcome his fear. This means that he will have to deactivate his belief that all dogs are dangerous so he can properly install a belief about dogs that is more consistent with his desire. We know that dogs can express themselves in a wide range of ways, from loving and gentle to mean and nasty. However, very few dogs on a percentage basis fall into the mean and nasty category. A good belief for the boy to adopt, then, would be something like, most dogs are friendly, but some can be mean and nasty. This belief would allow him to learn to recognize characteristics and behavior patterns that will tell him which dogs he can play with and which ones to avoid. However, the larger issue is, how can the boy deactivate the all in the belief that all dogs are dangerous so he can overcome his fear? Remember that all beliefs naturally resist any force that would alter their present form. But, as I just indicated, the appropriate approach is not to try to alter the belief, but rather to draw the energy out of it and channel that energy into another belief that is better suited to our purposes. To deactivate the concept the word all represents, the boy will have to create a positively charged experience with the dog. At some point, he will have to step through his fear and touch one. Doing this might require a great deal of effort on the boy's part over a considerable amount of time. Early in the process, his new realization about dogs might be strong enough only to allow him to be in the presence of a dog, at a distance, and not run away. However, each encounter with a dog, even at a distance, that doesn't result in a negative outcome will draw more and more of the negative energy out of his belief that all dogs are dangerous. Eventually, each new positive experience will allow him to close the gap between himself and a dog little by little, to the point that he can actually touch one. From an energy dynamics perspective, he will be able to touch a dog when his desire to do so is at least 1 degree greater in intensity than his belief that all dogs are dangerous. The moment he actually does touch a dog, it will have the effect of drawing most of the remaining negative energy out of the all concept and transfer it to a belief that reflects his new experience. Although it's probably not that common, there are people who, for various reasons, are motivated enough to purposely put themselves through the previously described process. However, they may not be consciously aware of the dynamics involved. People who work through a childhood fear of this magnitude usually do so somewhat haphazardly over a period of years, without knowing for sure exactly how they did it, unless they seek and get competent professional help. Later on, as adults, if they are asked or if they happen to encounter a situation that reminds them of their past, for instance, observing a child who is terrified of dogs, they typically characterize the process they went through as, "I remember when I was afraid of dogs, but I grew out of it." The end result of the first scenario was that the boy worked through his fear by deactivating his limiting belief about the nature of dogs. This allowed him to express himself in a way that he finds pleasing and that otherwise would have been impossible. The second scenario that could result from the child's inadvertent creative experience with dogs is that he isn't attracted to the possibility of playing with a dog. In other words, he could care less about being like the other children or interacting with dogs. In this case, His belief that all dogs are dangerous and his new realization that all dogs are not dangerous will exist in his mental environment as contradictory concepts. This is an example of what I call an active contradiction, when two active beliefs are in direct conflict with each other, both demanding expression. In this example, the first belief exists at a core level in the boy's mental environment with a great deal of negatively charged energy. The second belief is at a more superficial level and has very little positively charged energy. The dynamics of this situation are interesting and extremely important. We have stated that beliefs control our perception of information. Under normal circumstances, the boy would have been perceptually blinded to the possibility of interacting with dogs. But the experience of seeing other children playing with them created a positively charged concept in his mental environment that dogs are not all dangerous. Some can be friendly. However, he hasn't done anything to deactivate the all in his belief that all dogs are dangerous. And as far as I know, beliefs have no capacity to deactivate themselves. As a result, beliefs exist in our mental environment from the moment they are born to the moment we die, unless we consciously take steps to deactivate them. However, in this scenario, the boy has no desire and consequently no motivation to step through his fear. Therefore, the boy is left with an active contradiction where his minimally charged belief that not all dogs are dangerous gives him the ability to perceive the possibility of playing with a dog. But his powerfully charged belief that all dogs are dangerous still causes him to experience some level of fear every time he encounters a dog. Maybe not enough fear to cause him to run in terror, because some of that fear will be offset by the other belief. But there will certainly be enough fear to cause a great deal of discomfort. The ability to see, and consequently know that a situation is not dangerous, but at the same time find ourselves immobilized with fear, can be quite baffling if we don't understand that what we discover as the result of thinking creatively or realize from an inadvertent creative experience doesn't necessarily have enough energy to become a dominant force in our mental environment. In other words, our new awareness or discovery could very well have enough energy to act as a credible force on our perception of information, thereby causing us to perceive possibilities that would otherwise be invisible. But it might not have enough energy to act as a credible force on our behavior. In making this statement, I am operating out of the assumption that it takes more energy to act or express ourselves than the amount of energy it takes to observe something. On the other hand, new awareness and discoveries instantly and effortlessly become dominant forces if there's nothing inside us that's in conflict with them. But if there are conflicting beliefs, and we aren't willing to deactivate the conflicting forces, expending some effort, especially if they're negatively charged, then acting on what we've discovered will be a struggle at the very least, and perhaps downright impossible. What I have just described is the psychological dilemma that virtually every trader has to resolve. Let's say you have a firm grasp of the nature of probabilities, and as a result, you know that the next trade is simply another trade in a series of trades that has a probable outcome. Yet you find you're still afraid to put that next trade on, or you're still susceptible to several of the fear-based trading errors we've discussed in previous chapters. Remember that the underlying cause of fear is the potential to define and interpret market information as threatening. What is the source of our potential to interpret market information as threatening? Our expectations. When the market generates information that doesn't conform to what we expect, the up and down ticks seem to take on a threatening quality, becoming negatively charged. Consequently, we experience fear, stress, and anxiety. What is the underlying source of our expectations? Our beliefs. In light of what you now understand about the nature of beliefs, if you are still experiencing negative states of mind when you trade, you can assume there's a conflict between what you know about probable outcomes and any number of other beliefs in your mental environment that are arguing, demanding expression, for something else. Keep in mind that all active beliefs demand expression, even if we don't want them to. To think in probabilities, you have to believe that every moment in the market is unique, or more specifically, that every edge has a unique outcome. When you believe at a functional level that every edge has a unique outcome, meaning that it's a dominant belief without any other beliefs arguing for something different, you will experience a state of mind that is free of fear, stress, and anxiety when you trade. It really can't work any other way. A unique outcome is not something we have already experienced. Therefore, it is not something we can already know. If it were known, it could not be defined as unique. When you believe that you don't know what is going to happen next, what exactly are you expecting from the market? If you said, "I don't know," you are absolutely right. If you believe that something will happen and that you don't need to know exactly what that something is to make money, then where's the potential to define and interpret market information as threatening and painful? If you said, "There is none," you are absolutely right again. Here is one more example of how beliefs demand expression. Let's look at a situation where a child's first encounter with a dog was a very positive experience. As a result, he has absolutely no problem interacting with dogs, any dog for that matter, because he has not encountered one that's unfriendly. Therefore, he has no concept, an energized belief, that it is possible for a dog to inflict any damage or cause him to experience pain. As he learns to associate words with his memories, he will probably acquire a belief along the lines of, "All dogs are friendly and fun." Therefore, every time a dog comes into his field of awareness, this belief will demand expression. From the perspective of someone who has had a negative experience with a dog, it will seem as if this child has an attitude of reckless abandon. If you tried to convince the child that he'll get bitten someday if he doesn't exercise caution, his belief will cause him to either discount or completely disregard your advice. His response would be something like, "No way," or, "It can't happen to me." Let's say at some point in his life, he approaches an unfamiliar dog that wants to be left alone. The dog growls. The warning will go unheeded, and the dog attacks the boy. From the perspective of the boy's belief system, he's just had a creative experience. What effect will this experience have on his belief that all dogs are friendly? Will he now be afraid of all dogs, as the child in the first example was? Unfortunately, the answers to these questions are not cut and dried, because there may be other beliefs, also demanding expression, that don't have anything specifically to do with dogs, but nonetheless can come into play in a situation like this. For example, what if this child has a highly developed belief in betrayal? He believes he's been betrayed by some very significant people in some very significant situations that have caused him to experience intense emotional pain. If he associates the attack by this one dog as a betrayal by dogs in general, in essence a betrayal of his belief in dogs, then he could easily find himself afraid of all dogs. All of the positive energy contained in his original belief could instantly be transformed into negatively charged energy. The boy could justify this shift with a rationalization like, "If one dog can betray me, then any dog can." However, I do think this is an extreme and very unlikely occurrence. What is more likely is the word "all" in his original belief will instantly be deactivated, and that energy will get transferred to a new belief that better reflects the true nature of dogs. This new experience caused an energy shift that forced him to learn something about the nature of dogs that he otherwise refused to consider possible. His belief in the friendliness of dogs remains intact. He will still play with dogs, but he will now exercise some discretion by consciously looking for signs of friendliness or unfriendliness. I think that a fundamental truth about the nature of our existence is every moment in the market, as well as in everyday life, has elements of what we know, similarities, and elements that we don't or can't know because we haven't experienced it yet. Until we actively train our minds to expect a unique outcome, we will continue experiencing only what we know. Everything else, other information and possibilities that are not consistent with what we know and expect, will pass us by, unperceived, discounted, distorted, outright denied, or attacked. When you truly believe that you don't need to know, you will be thinking in probabilities, the market perspective, and will have no reason to block, discount, distort, deny, or attack anything the market is offering about its potential to move in any particular direction. If you are not experiencing the quality of mental freedom implied in that statement, and it is your desire to do so, then you must take an active role in training your mind to believe in the uniqueness of each moment, and you must deactivate any other belief that argues for something different. This process isn't any different from the one the boy in the first scenario went through, nor is it going to happen by itself. He wanted to interact with dogs without fear, but to do so, he had to create a new belief and deactivate the conflicting ones. This is the secret to achieving consistent success as a trader. 3. Beliefs keep on working, regardless of whether we are consciously aware of their existence in our mental environment. In other words, we don't have to actively remember or have conscious access to any particular belief for that belief to act as a force on our perception of information or on our behavior. I know it's hard to believe that something we can't even remember can still have an impact on our lives. But when you think about it, much of what we learn throughout our lives is stored at an unconscious or subconscious level. If I asked you to remember each specific skill you had to learn so that you could drive a car with confidence, chances are you wouldn't remember all the things you needed to concentrate and focus on while you were in the process of learning. The first time I had the opportunity to teach a teenager how to drive, I was absolutely amazed at how much there was to learn, how much of the process I took for granted and no longer thought about at a conscious level. Possibly the best example that illustrates this characteristic is people who drive under the influence of alcohol. On any given day or night, there are probably thousands of people who have had so much to drink that they have no idea that they have no conscious awareness of how they drove from point A to point B. It is difficult to imagine how this is possible, unless you consider that driving skills and one's belief in his ability to drive operate automatically on a much deeper level than waking consciousness. Certainly, some percentage of these drunk drivers get into accidents. But when you compare the accident rate with the estimated number of people driving under the influence of alcohol, it's remarkable that there aren't a great many more accidents. In fact, a drunk driver is probably most likely to cause an accident when he either falls asleep or something requires a conscious decision and a fast reaction. In other words, the driving conditions are such that operating out of one's subconscious skills is not enough. Self-valuation and trading. How this characteristic applies to our trading is also quite profound. The trading environment offers us an arena of unlimited opportunities to accumulate wealth. But just because the money is available and we can perceive the possibility of getting it, that doesn't necessarily mean that we, as individuals, have an unlimited sense of self-valuation. In other words, there could be a huge gap between how much money we desire for ourselves, how much we perceive is available, and how much we actually believe we are worth or deserve. Everyone has a sense of self-valuation. The easiest way to describe this sense is to list every active belief, both conscious and subconscious, that has the potential to argue, either for or against, accumulating or achieving greater and greater levels of success and prosperity. Then match the energy from the positively charged beliefs against the energy from the negatively charged beliefs. If you have more positively charged energy arguing for success and prosperity than negatively charged energy arguing against them, then you have a positive sense of self-valuation. Otherwise, you have a negative sense of self-valuation. The dynamics of how these beliefs interact with one another is not nearly so simple as I'm making it sound. In fact, it can be so complex that it could take years of sophisticated mental work to organize and sort out. What you need to know is that it's almost impossible to grow up in any social environment and not acquire some negatively charged beliefs that would argue against success or accumulating vast sums of money. Most of these self-sabotaging beliefs have long been forgotten and operate at a subconscious level. But the fact that we may have forgotten them doesn't mean they've been deactivated. How do we acquire self-sabotaging beliefs? Unfortunately, it's extremely easy. Probably the most common way is when a child engages in some activity that a parent or teacher doesn't want him to do, and the child accidentally injures himself. Many parents, to get their point across to the child, will respond to a situation like this by saying, "This, whatever pain you are experiencing, wouldn't have happened to you if you didn't deserve it." Or, "You disobeyed me and look what happened. God punished you." The problem with making or hearing statements like this is that there's a potential for the child to associate every future injury with these same statements, and subsequently form a belief that he must be an unworthy person, undeserving of success, happiness, or love. Anything we feel guilty about can have an adverse effect on our sense of self-worth. Usually, guilt is associated with being a bad person, and most people believe that bad people should be punished, certainly not rewarded. Some religions teach children that having a lot of money isn't godly or spiritual. Some people believe that making money in certain ways is wrong, even though it may be perfectly legal and moral from society's perspective. Again, you may not have a specific recollection of learning something that would argue against the success you perceive as possible. But that doesn't mean that what you learned is no longer having an effect. The way these subconscious, self-sabotaging beliefs manifest themselves in our trading is usually in the form of lapses in focus or concentration, resulting in any number of trading errors, like putting in a buy for a sell, or vice versa, or allowing yourself to give in to distracting thoughts that compel you to leave the screen, only to find out when you return that you missed the big trade of the day. I've worked with many traders who achieved various levels of consistent success, but found they just couldn't break through certain thresholds in acquiring equity. They discovered an invisible but very real barrier, similar to the proverbial glass ceiling that many women executives experience in the corporate world. Every time these traders hit the barrier, they experienced a significant drawdown, regardless of the market conditions. However, when asked about what happened, they typically blame their sudden run of bad luck on just that: luck, or the vagaries of the market. Interestingly, they typically created a steadily rising equity curve, sometimes over a period of several months, and the significant drawdown always occurred at the same spot in their equity curve. I describe the psychological phenomenon as being in a negative zone. As magically as money can flow into a trader's accounts when he is in the zone, it can just as easily flow out if he is in a negative zone where unresolved self-valuation issues mysteriously act on his perception of information and behavior. I am not implying here that you have to deactivate every belief that would argue against your ever-expanding positive sense of self-valuation, because you don't. But you must be aware of the presence of such beliefs and take specific steps in your trading regimen to compensate when they start expressing themselves. Chapter 11. Thinking Like a Trader. If you ask me to distill trading down to its simplest form, I would say that it is a pattern recognition numbers game. We use market analysis to identify the patterns, define the risk, and determine when to take profits. The trade either works or it doesn't. In any case, we go on to the next trade. It's that simple. But it's certainly not easy. In fact, trading is probably the hardest thing you'll ever attempt to be successful at. That's not because it requires intellect. Quite the contrary. But because the more you think you know, the less successful you'll be. Trading is hard because you have to operate in a state of not having to know, even though your analysis may turn out at times to be perfectly correct. To operate in a state of not having to know, you have to properly manage your expectations. To properly manage your expectations, you must realign your mental environment so that you believe without a shadow of a doubt in the five fundamental truths. In this chapter, I'm going to give you a trading exercise that will integrate these truths about the market at a functional level in your mental environment. In the process, I'll take you through the three stages of development of a trader. The first stage is the mechanical stage. In this stage, you 1. Build the self-trust necessary to operate in an unlimited environment. 2. Learn to flawlessly execute a trading system. 3. Train your mind to think in probabilities, the five fundamental truths. 4. Create a strong, unshakable belief in your consistency as a trader. Once you have completed this first stage, you can then advance to the subjective stage of trading. In this stage, you use anything you have ever learned about the nature of market movement to do whatever it is you want to do. There's a lot of freedom in this stage, so you will have to learn how to monitor your susceptibility to make the kind of trading errors that are the result of any unresolved self-valuation issues I referred to in the last chapter. The third stage is the intuitive stage. Trading intuitively is the most advanced stage of development. It is the trading equivalent of earning a black belt in the martial arts. The difference is that you can't try to be intuitive, because intuition is spontaneous. It doesn't come from what we know at a rational level. The rational part of our mind seems to be inherently mistrustful of information received from a source that it doesn't understand. Sensing that something is about to happen is a form of knowing that is very different from anything we know rationally. I've worked with many traders who frequently had a very strong intuitive sense of what was going to happen next, only to be confronted with the rational part of themselves that consistently argued for another course of action. Of course, if they had followed their intuition, they would have experienced a very satisfying outcome. Instead, what they ended up with was usually very unsatisfactory, especially when compared with what they otherwise perceived as possible. The only way I know of that you can try to be intuitive is to work at setting up a state of mind most conducive to receiving and acting on your intuitive impulses. The mechanical stage. The mechanical stage of trading is specifically designed to build the kind of trading skills, trust, confidence, and thinking in probabilities that will virtually compel you to create consistent results. I define consistent results as a steadily rising equity curve with only minor drawdowns that are the natural consequence of edges that didn't work. Other than finding a pattern that puts the odds of a winning trade in your favor, achieving a steadily rising equity curve is a function of systematically eliminating any susceptibility you may have to making the kind of fear, euphoric, or self-valuation-based trading errors I have described throughout this audiobook. Eliminating the errors and expanding your sense of self-valuation will require the acquisition of skills that are all psychological in nature. The skills are psychological because each one, in its purest form, is simply a belief. Remember that the beliefs we operate out of will determine our state of mind and shape our experiences in ways that constantly reinforce what we already believe to be true. How truthful a belief is, relative to the environmental conditions, can be determined by how well it serves us. That is, the degree to which it helps us satisfy our objectives. If producing consistent results is your primary objective as a trader, then creating a belief, a conscious, energized concept that resists change and demands expression, that I am a consistently successful trader, will act as a primary source of energy that will manage your perceptions, interpretations, expectations, and actions in ways that satisfy the belief and, consequently, the objective. Creating a dominant belief that I am a consistently successful trader requires adherence to several principles of consistent success. Some of these principles will undoubtedly be in direct conflict with some of the beliefs you've already acquired about trading. If this is the case, then what you have is a classic example of beliefs that are in direct conflict with desire. The energy dynamic here is no different from what it was for the boy who wanted to be like the other children, who were not afraid to play with dogs. He desired to express himself in a way that he found, at least initially, virtually impossible. To satisfy his desire, he had to step into an active process of transformation. His technique was simple. He tried as hard as he could to stay focused on what he was trying to accomplish, and little by little, he deactivated the conflicting belief and strengthened the belief that was consistent with his desire. At some point, if that's your desire, then you will have to step into the process of transforming yourself into a consistent winner. When it comes to personal transformation, the most important ingredients are your willingness to change, the clarity of your intent, and the strength of your desire. Ultimately, for this process to work, you must choose consistency over every other reason or justification you have for trading. If all of these ingredients are sufficiently present, then regardless of the internal obstacles you find yourself up against, what you desire will eventually prevail. Observe yourself. The first step in the process of creating consistency is to start noticing what you're thinking, saying, and doing. Why? Because everything we think, say, or do as a trader contributes to, and therefore reinforces, some belief in our mental system. Because the process of becoming consistent is psychological in nature, it shouldn't come as a surprise that you'll have to start paying attention to your various psychological processes. The idea is eventually to learn to become an objective observer of your own thoughts, words, and deeds. Your first line of defense against committing a trading error is to catch yourself thinking about it. Of course, the last line of defense is to catch yourself in the act. If you don't commit yourself to becoming an observer to these processes, your realizations will always come after the experience, usually when you are in a state of deep regret and frustration. Observing yourself objectively implies doing it without judgment or any harsh criticism as a consequence for what you're noticing about yourself. This might not be so easy for some of you to do, considering the harsh, judgmental treatment you may have received from other people throughout your life. As a result, one quickly learns to associate any mistake with emotional pain. No one likes to be in a state of emotional pain, so we typically avoid acknowledging what we have learned to define as a mistake for as long as possible. Not confronting mistakes in our everyday lives usually doesn't have the same disastrous consequences it can have if we avoid confronting our mistakes as traders. For example, when I am working with floor traders, the analogy I use to illustrate how precarious a situation they are in is to ask them to imagine themselves walking across a bridge over the Grand Canyon. The width of the bridge is directly related to the number of contracts they trade. So, for example, for a one-contract trader, the bridge is very wide, say 20 feet. A bridge 20 feet wide allows you a great deal of tolerance for error, so you don't have to be inordinately careful or focused on each step you take. Still, if you do happen to stumble and trip over the edge, the drop to the canyon floor is 1 mile. I don't know how many people would walk across a narrow bridge with no guardrails, where the ground is a mile down, but my guess is relatively few. Similarly, few people will take the kinds of risks associated with trading on the floor of the futures exchanges. Certainly, a one-contract floor trader can do a great deal of damage to himself, not unlike falling off a mile-high bridge. But a one-contract trader also can give himself a wide tolerance for errors, miscalculations, or unusually violent market moves where he could find himself on the wrong side. On the other hand, one of the biggest floor traders I ever worked with trades for his own account with an average position of 500 treasury bond futures at a time. he often puts on a position of well over 1,000 contracts. A position of 1,000 T-bond contracts amounts to $31,500 per tick, the smallest incremental price change that a bond contract can make. Of course, T-bond futures can be very volatile and can trade several ticks in either direction in a matter of seconds. As the size of a trader's position increases, the width of our bridge over the Grand Canyon narrows. In the case of the large bond trader, the bridge has narrowed to the size of a thin wire. Obviously, he has to be extremely well-balanced and very focused on each step that he takes. The slightest misstep or gust of wind could cause him to fall off the wire. Next stop, 1 mile down. Now, when he's in the trading pit, that tiny misstep or slight gust of wind is the equivalent to one distracting thought. That's all. Just a thought. Or anything else where he allows himself to lose his focus for even a second or two. In that moment of distraction, he could miss his last favorable opportunity to liquidate his position. The next price level with enough volume to take him out of his trade could be several ticks away, either creating a huge loss or forcing him to give a substantial winning trade back to the market. If producing consistent results is a function of eliminating errors, then it is an understatement to say that you will encounter great difficulty in achieving your objective if you can't acknowledge a mistake. Obviously, this is something very few people can do, and it accounts for why there are so few consistent winners. In fact, the tendency not to acknowledge a mistake is so pervasive throughout mankind, it could lead one to assume that it's an inherent characteristic of human nature. I do not believe this is the case, nor do I believe we are born with the capacity to ridicule or think less of ourselves for making a mistake, miscalculation, or error. Making mistakes is a natural function of living, and will continue to be until we reach a point at which 1. All our beliefs are in absolute harmony with our desires, and 2. All our beliefs are structured in such a way that they are completely consistent with what works from the environment's perspective. Obviously, if our beliefs are not consistent with what works from the environment's perspective, the potential for making a mistake is high, if not inevitable. We won't be able to perceive the appropriate set of steps to our objective. Worse, we won't be able to perceive that what we want may not be available, or available in the quantity we desire, or at the time when we want it. On the other hand, mistakes that are the result of beliefs that are in conflict with our objectives aren't always apparent or obvious. We know they will act as opposing forces, expressing their versions of the truth on our consciousness, and they can do that in many ways. The most difficult to detect is a distracting thought that causes a momentary lapse in focus or concentration. On the surface, this may not sound significant. But, as in the analogy of the bridge over the canyon, when there's a lot at stake, even a slightly diminished capacity to stay focused can result in an error of disastrous proportions. This principle applies whether it's trading, sporting events, or computer programming. When our intent is clear and undiminished by any opposing energy, then our capacity to stay focused is greater, and the more likely it is that we will accomplish our objective. Earlier, I defined a winning attitude as a positive expectation of our efforts, with an acceptance that whatever results we get are a perfect reflection of our level of development and what we need to learn to do better. What separates the consistently great athletes and performers from everyone else is their distinct lack of fear of making a mistake. The reason they aren't afraid is that they don't have a reason to think less of themselves when they do make a mistake, meaning they don't have a reservoir of negatively charged energy waiting to well up and pounce on their conscious thought process, like a lion waiting for the right moment to pounce on its intended prey. What accounts for this uncommon capacity to quickly move beyond their errors without criticizing themselves? One explanation may be that they grew up with extremely unusual parents, teachers, and coaches who, by their words and examples, taught them to correct their miscalculations and errors with genuine love, affection, and acceptance. I say extremely unusual because many of us grew up with just the opposite experience. We were taught to correct our mistakes or miscalculations with anger, impatience, and a distinct lack of acceptance. Is it possible that for the great athletes, their past positive experiences with respect to mistakes caused them to acquire a belief that mistakes simply point the way to where they need